Is there a song that you'd like to be remembered by?
No. And yes. And I'm a greedy person. I just love so much and so many. maybe this one.
Program of the African Sisters Media Network, and we are celebrating quite a few things today. We're celebrating liberation of people of African descent from enslavement, otherwise known as Juneteenth, which is next week on the 19th. And we are also celebrating Fathers. This is Father's Day weekend. And we are so happy to be joined in the studio by Bill Doggett, curator and lecturer and scholar. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you again. You're just one of our special return guests, and we're happy that you're joining us again this morning to talk about your program that you're going to be hosting at the African American Museum and Library at Oakland tomorrow, Saturday, June 16th. And we're also joined by your co-collaborator on the film that you're going to be showing, Andy Kimmel. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to read some of your bio, Bill. It's just so, gosh, extensive and just impressive. My goodness.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. The program I mentioned that you're going to be hosting tomorrow is entitled The Civil War at 150 Years, The Negro Spiritual and the Underground Railroad, a lecture and video presentation by exhibitions curator Bill Doggett. And I'll let you tell us more about the lecture. And it's a free event. And, again, it's going to be at the African American Museum and Library. It's going to start at 2 o'clock, and that's located in Oakland on 14th Street at Martin Luther King Jr. Way. Martin Luther King Jr., not Martin Luther King Jr. Way, that's Berkeley. Let's see, where do we start with your bio? Here we are. Bill Doggett is respected and experienced exhibitions curator and independent archivist based in Oakland, California. He is a graduate of the University of California, Los Angeles, with a cum laude and bachelor's degree in political science. He transferred to UCLA from Georgetown University in his sophomore year. Additionally, he is a founding director of the Los Angeles Opera's African Americans for LA Opera, serving in an audience development community outreach capacity from 1994 to 1999. Inspired by the life work of the legendary African American archivist and curator, Arthur Schomburg, whose collection established the New York Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, Doggett's goal is to lecture and create an educational outreach resource with his archive of rare historic ephemera and recordings. He's from a Philadelphia-based musical family with associations to Marian Anderson, Roland Hayes, and he has been engaged in historic preservation from a young age, rescuing historical ephemera of his parents and grandparents thought to be lost. And it's really quite significant that Bill is going to be hosting his lecture tomorrow at the African American Museum and Library at Oakland, because AMLO, as we call it, is to the West Coast what Schomburg is to the East Coast, and together they are really significant repositories of African American history and culture. AMLO specifically focused on California black folks, the history of African Americans in California. So I'm going to let you, Bill, tell us about Andy, you know, your collaborator, who together, you know, you all have made a film. I believe you're a part of the film as well. So why don't we talk about that? Why don't you introduce us to Andy? His bio is, you know, quite small, and I'm sure you probably can elaborate on it a bit, talking about his organization, which I think is really cool, Remember Us. That's a really nice term. So go ahead, Bill.
Yes, well, it is my pleasure to introduce it. Andy Kimmel is a guru of video and film, digital film editing. He has essentially taken the concept of the, let's say, historical family reunion, let's say photographs, historical photographs, let's say that your grandparents or your great-grandparents may have had, you know, handed down through the years, and then your parents had. He's used still photographs mixed and converged with live, you know, live video, and done it in a way using music and other elements that just in itself creates its own film. It's a beautiful thing. So what Andy has done for me is basically take storyboards. Like, storyboard is basically the idea of kind of like a cartoon creating a sequence of events. So storyboards is a term that's used in filmmaking, and especially in Hollywood, where a film designer or a set designer will actually spell out the code of action or how the look of something will be. So I basically came to him with a storyboard of ideas of what I wanted to create, and obviously provided the product images, and gave him just basically the architecture, and he created this incredible, this beautifully moving, this poignant piece that is just amazing. I'm so much looking forward to having the public see it. When I saw it for the first time, even in its sample, trial version, I was just floored. You know, I was originally based in Los Angeles. My family's from Philadelphia, but I have a very deep cinematography history background, and so the interest in moving images and an interest, if you will, in the camera, there's a whole cinematography terminology, the camera as protagonist in a film. essentially, that's what Andy's done is has used the camera and the way he's used the camera digitally to edit historical images of the illustrations of the slavery experience, slaves being captured, the Middle Passage, the experience of slavery in the United States, as well as historical photographs, all paired to music. In this particular case, the three spirituals sung by a wonderful African-American soprano, Barbara Hendricks. It's just amazing. It's just amazing. So I am just honored. This was envisioned as a short film, basically a video to accompany my lecture, but this is also a standalone piece, and that's what has become quite interesting, and I'm actually very much looking forward to even expanding it beyond that to the point where it becomes a standalone short film.
And perhaps you could tell us sort of how this fits within the context of your lecture that you're going to be presenting.
Sure. The film essentially, the film is in two parts. There's an intro part and then there's a second part. How it fits, it basically sets the tone. The first piece is a 2.5 minute, let's say almost a 3 minute piece, based on the song, the Negro spiritual, "I've Been in the Storm So Long." That by itself sets the tone. I'm setting the tone to my lecture, so I'm going to present this first part before I even begin to speak. And that this particular part of this film showcases an Aquarian map of Africa. It showcases photographs and illustrations of African villages that are, from the 14th, 15th, 16th century, before the Portuguese and Spaniards came to the west coast of Africa. And then it also continues, of course, with the historical illustrations of Africans being captured, of, the slave, basically the African holding, slave holding corridors, the famous gates leading down into the slave ships. And then the whole trauma, images of the trauma of the Middle Passage arriving in the Americas, the slave holding, auction holding places, images of the famous images, actually photographs in the early photography, I think they're called daguerreotypes of...
the
daguerreotypes of, slaves that have been beaten to, almost beaten to death. There's a very famous one that I include in this where the markings on the back of this, the permanent damage to this particular male slave is a symbol, is emblematic of the trauma of what enslaved Africans in the Americas went through. So the film, the first part of the film, as I said, based on the Negro spiritual, "I've Been in the Storm So Long," beautifully sung as a solo, an a cappella by Barbara Hendricks, just as very powerful by itself. The second part of the film showcases, again, Barbara Hendricks, but this time with the Moses Hogan Chorale, Moses Hogan being a very famous choral arranger and conductor of Negro spirituals, unfortunately, who died, I believe, in 2007. The Moses Hogan Chorale continued the tradition of the even more famous Chester Harrison Chorale of showcasing the long legacy of the Negro spiritual with new arrangements. And this particular recording of one of the signature spirituals of the Underground Railroad experience, "Steal Away," as well as "Did My Lord Deliver Daniel," is also, again, using images of early photographs of slaves, images of the whole experience of wanting a sense of dignity and freedom, as well as using my archival recorded sound archive. I'm using images, what Andy has done, I provided him with images of some of the earliest recordings of the Negro spiritual that are in existence, that are in my collection. And what has happened is he has merged, this film has created this sense of rhythm, this sense of poignancy to really drive the point home of what the experience of going from freedom in Africa to the desire for freedom in the Americas, what that really means. So that's how the film is used.
Oh,
what's so funny?
Oh, I just it sounds just really fantastic. You know, the lecture is exploring the relationship of deep faith and spirituality of African American slaves, and the special role of the Negro spiritual as metaphor and coded message for slaves escaping to the North. And you write that the lecture will showcase rare 1845 to 1865 anti-slavery abolitionist newspapers, 1910 to 1930 recordings, as you mentioned, of Negro spirituals and sermons, with singing in addition to three provocative spirituals that you mentioned, sung by Barbara Hendricks. And so I was wondering, Andy, as the filmmaker, you know, sort of how, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of times, depending on what the materials are that you're using to create your, you know, the document or the piece, that it might have an emotional impact on you. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of how you worked with regard with these materials, and the effect of the materials on your person as you were, you know, the artist creating this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a really great project to take on. He provided some great material. And when I start a project, I like to get everything, all the photos and videos together, so I know what I have to work with. And then it kind of falls into place, you know, what goes where. And Bill was very specific about, you know, the order that he wanted them in and certain fade-ins and fade-outs, and that was fine. But, yeah, it was very powerful material, and one of the things I specialize in is telling your story. Many other videographers, they get the material, and they say, oh, I know what to do with this, and they put it in their little template and ship it out, and they're on to the next, and I don't really do that. I like to produce a final version that is representative of what the customer wants and tell their story in the way that, you know, that's not branded by anybody else, that shows, yeah, this is my style, and I hope he was happy with it.
Mm-hmm. More than happy with it, to say the least. Actually, I have to chime in there. What Andy did is actually something much more than any videographer who is in this industry does. He used, I'm going to say, for it's kind of a generic term that's hard to define over the radio, but he used filmic motion to create not just a statement, but his use of filmic motion, his use of camera movement, his use of actually having worked in Hollywood with, you know, behind the camera, he used the sense of panning, dissolving in, dissolving out, and all of the different kinds of film editorial devices that are often used, let's say, and actually perfected by, if I can even put this in, by Ken Burns. If you are familiar with the Ken Burns documentary, what Andy has done has basically taken that idea but created it in his own way and used still images in a way that by itself creates its own documentary. I mean, it's amazing. I was more than pleased. I was just astounded by the bravura technical skill that is shown by this. This is a beautiful film. I'm hoping that everyone listening with this very, very busy Saturday that's going on both sides, the East Bay and in San Francisco, that those who are interested in history, and especially African-American history and around this whole concept of the Civil War at 150 years, you know, that's been going on, this is a commemoration of a signature event in American culture, you know, 1861 to 1865. This is a signature event that is being commemorated all across the country beginning last year. Of course, this year being particularly important because as we introduce the idea of Juneteenth, which is June 19th, Juneteenth is essentially, you know, an African-American holiday that commemorates the date of June 19th, 1865, when Union troops arrived in the West Texas city of Galveston to announce the fact that that Lincoln had freed the slaves. You know, and slavery, the issue of being free for African Americans, is still a contemporary issue. It was an issue that drove the March on Washington. Martin Luther King, in his I Have a Dream speech, makes the connection between, you know, we are still 100 years later, still looking for dignity, still looking for freedom. So it's, so what Annie did was to take all of this, the sensibility that I've been just talking about, the sensibility of desire for freedom and for dignity that West Africans had, and then suddenly that was interrupted for centuries, and then the whole experience of slavery, the whole trauma of slavery, and the attempt to be free as a people in the 1860s, you know, and in, you know, going 1890s, obviously, all the way through today, is, you know, all of it is still quite, quite relevant.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was wondering, Bill, if you could talk about how this particular lecture fits within the context of your work as a curator as well. That's, I remember, well, you noticed when you sent me the press release, I asked if this was in conjunction with an exhibition, because, you know, I know you as a curator as well as
right.
a lecturer, and,
right.
You know, you have the wonderful exhibit you did connected to African-American concert singers, and that was really wonderful. That was, you know, 1900 to 1963 Porgy and Bess from Broadway to San Francisco for San Francisco Opera and the Underground Railroad, Songs of Hope and Freedom, the Civil War, 150 years. And then, you know, you've been on the air talking about Paul Robeson and then I noticed that, you know, you've given lectures in Southern California at the University of California, Irvine. And just wondering sort of if you could talk about sort of the context of this lecture in light of your broad palette with regards to, you know, African-American singers.
Right. What I can say simply is this. I'll start it this way. Although I am an exhibitions curator, I have a fixed archive. So whether I have an exhibition where I have a lecture connected to the exhibition that, you know, speaks about it, which is a natural thing, you know, a side event to any exhibition, I am now, you know, also looking at the fact that even if I don't have an exhibition, I have a body of material and certainly a body of knowledge that has value and is of interest to people to talk about. So the connect. So what you mentioned, I want to just clarify for the listeners, what is being talked about is that I am an exhibitionist curator who debuted in 2009 in San Francisco with a very well-received exhibition at the main library of San Francisco Public Library on the African-American concert singer, basically from I'm going to kind of recreate the title. It was the story of the African-American concert singer from slave songs and Negro spirituals to the concert and opera house, and basically looked at the untold story of the connection, the important connection of a particular individual, Paul Paws, who was the Polish Jewish concert manager of the San Francisco Opera Concert Series, who made it possible for a whole legacy, if you will, of, I want to call it, what would I even call it? I would say basically a whole legacy of opportunity, I think is the best way to put it, for singers of African descent, singers like Marian Anderson, Dorothy Maynard, you know, fast forward to Leontine Price, to recognize that San Francisco was a special place. It was a special opportunity. So even though I lectured on that, connected with that exhibition, I can lecture on that, as I did at the University of California, Irvine, in a symposium and talk about that without the exhibition. So in this particular case, as you referenced, the Underground Railroad exhibition that I had last year, this time last year at the main library at San Francisco Public Library, I had a exhibition and also a talk in July at the Corret Auditorium about this. So this particular lecture that is tomorrow, Saturday, at the African American Museum and Library at Oakland is far more involved, far more engaged. And this particular lecture I'm doing, not only the film, not only, you know, it's the world premiere of this wonderful 9-minute film in two parts, but I'm also doing a major PowerPoint lecture, PowerPoint being, you know, using a computer to showcase through projected screen images from my archive. In this particular case, as you mentioned, one of the signature parts of this will be a whole series of newspapers, anti-slavery newspapers, as well as newspapers from New York, the New York Tribune from the 1840s, 1852, 1857, 1858, 1859, all newspapers right before the Civil War begins, that I'm going to use to look at the dissonance of public opinion. So there are a whole series of editorials that I'm going to feature and talk about that speak to the issue of the view of slavery, the view of African-Americans, Africans versus African-Americans, the view, I know that sounds kind of controversial, but there is a look at that. What is the benefit of being African and going back to Africa as opposed to staying in the United States? What, you know, the ills of slavery, the fact that there was slavery, an attempt to create slavery in California, all of that I'm going to be looking at through these various editorials and commentations that are in these antiquarian papers from the time leading up to the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about collecting and archives,
sure,
and the importance of that?
Well, for me, it is a deeply personal story. As a youngster growing up in Los Angeles, I had an opportunity to do a chore in the weekends by my mom, which was basically to take out a whole series of newspapers, journals, and magazines and throw them in the trash. But because of the fact, and I should back up here, my parents, the late Francis Doggett and Reverend John Doggett, were very active in the burgeoning and early civil rights movement in Los Angeles. My father was the treasurer of the Western Christian Leadership Conference in between the late 50s through about 1964-65. What that meant was that the both of them were voracious readers. And so because of the fact that I was asked to throw this stuff out, but somehow had this interest, this kind of, I call it a priori sense, kind of a Shirley MacLaine-ish kind of out-of-body sense of being a curator as a little boy, you know, I would actually sit down, go down in the basement, sit down and actually go through these and decide which ones had value to keep and which ones to throw away. And so collecting and preserving and the sense of being an archivist or a museum curator has been with me since, I'd say, age 7. I mean, because this task that I was given is from basically the time of when I was 7 to 10. And that started a whole sense of creating value not only for my family, which ended up being very important. My mother always mentioned to me, this is incredible, you know, that I had discovered her diary from when she was in junior high and high school. She had been looking, this would have been, let's say, circa 1969, 1970. She hadn't seen it since 1939. And I had found that. And that had great, and that actually informed her writing of her biography for her 75th birthday, because I found something that had been long lost. So value is huge in collecting, and I always encourage all of our listeners to look at what is within the confines of your house, your basement, your attic, not to just think, well, you know, when someone passes away and there's all this stuff, you know, yes, there may be medical bills and there may be, you know, unnecessary correspondence, but there are also gems. So collecting has been very important. So I started at an early age understanding and having a sense of value about history. My parents were very much engaged in history. If anyone in my family, and I'm laughing in a sense in a light way, if anyone in my family picked that up, it was me. I mean, really, really heavily. My mother, interestingly enough, and this is very related, not only being a historian, being from Philadelphia, she had a great love of singing, and specifically of Marian Anderson. Marian Anderson has been in my lexicon since I was a little boy. Marian Anderson, for the listeners, was a signature individual in the world of singing. She's an African American soprano, excuse me, contralto, who is from Philadelphia, whose perhaps first claim to fame in terms of history is her association with Eleanor Roosevelt and the Lincoln Memorial monument in Washington on the Easter Sunday of 1939, when she had been booked originally by the daughters, by the her concert booker, Sal Hurek, to sing at Constitution Hall, which was run by the Daughters of the American Revolution. Well, the Daughters of the American Revolution had a longstanding policy since a problem with a previous singer who was associated with Mary Nanson, Roland Hayes, in 1931, that African-Americans were not allowed to perform there. So they thought, by hearing her name, Mary Nanson, that she was Swedish, where in fact she was African-American. And so being refused to, at that time in 1938-39, where she was just becoming one of the most well-received singers in the world, helped basically the White House interceded on her behalf and gave her a platform, a world platform, on Easter Sunday, where 75,000 people showed up and millions more heard on the radio. It was one of the signature events of the early civil rights movement. Well, Marian Anderson was a great... Yes.
Bill, we're out of time, sorry.
Okay.
I want to give you an opportunity to let our audience know again about tomorrow's lecture. And I don't have a street address, so if you could tell people where the lecture is happening at the African American Museum and Library, Oakland, at 2 o'clock on Saturday, June 16th.
659 14th Street.
659
14th Street. From 2 to 4, we look forward to seeing you. It's a great film and quite a bit of illuminating information.
Right, super. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. And Andy, do you want to give your website?
Sure, thank you. It's remember.us. It's remember.us. And we specialize in custom multimedia, so check us out. We also have a Vimeo channel, vimeo.com/channel/rememberus.
Okay, super. And Bill, why don't you give your website?
Yes, it's www.BillDoggett, that's Bill Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T, productions.com.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you both so much for joining us, and Bill, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Wanda.
Are you taking care?
Okay, look forward to it.
Peace and blessings. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm blessed. I got a little last month, a little cold, but to be alive is a blessing. through all that I've been through, it's really a blessing to me to be able to get up.
So are we speaking to Mr. James?
Yes.
Okay. I thought I recognized your voice. And we have the filmmaker on, and we're going to be talking about a wonderful event that happened in Bayview Hunters Point. Gosh, what was it, 40 years ago, Caroline?
It nearly is 40 years ago. Next year will be, 40 years. in 1963.
Next year will be 40 or is it 40 next year?
Absolutely, James. Good to hear you.
it'll be 50 next year, I believe.
Oh, I think maybe you
63.
Might be right. It's 49 now. The math.
Okay, it's 50 years. Wow, that's a long time ago. Wow, that is so amazing. We're talking about a film that was made, a 1964 film that was made called Take This Hammer, and it was based on the author and archive and activist James Baldwin visiting Bayview Hunters Point in San Francisco in 1963 to meet with members of the local African-American community and uncover what he calls the real situation of Negroes in the city as opposed to the image San Francisco would like to present. And Baldwin meets with the community leaders and youth on the street in Hunters Point and the Fillmore and declares there is no moral distance between the facts of life in San Francisco and the facts of life in Birmingham, Alabama. And if people remember their history, this was a part, this particular period was a time of the civil rights movement. Baldwin says that someone's got to tell it like it is, and that's where it's at. And today, journalist Carolyn Caroline Benz, who's calling us from Mexico right now, has brought the camera back to Hunters Point to find and interview the youth on the corner who Baldwin spoke to in the film. Now senior citizens, these are her words, these residents reflect on film about Baldwin's visit, the 1960s Hunters Point riots, and the problems the community is facing today after 50 years of the neighborhood's continuing neglect by San Francisco city government. And it's so wonderful. We have on the air right now Mr. Oscar James. And
James Lockett.
Oh, Oscar James Lockett?
No, James Lockett. Oscar
oh, James Lockett. Oh, yeah,
no,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wrong, James.
Oscar
okay.
James.
Yeah, James Lockett. Okay.
It's a long time
yeah.
friend.
Okay, right. So Caroline is a Dutch journalist based in San Francisco now, and she has a Master's of Arts degree in Journalism and Contemporary History. And she's always been interested, she writes, in understanding the historical context of any event she covers. So she started out helping set up the first history channel in the Netherlands and has worked for daily radio news focusing on Europe, but the small human stories are the ones that give more insight in the world around her. She is volunteering at the San Francisco Bay Area Archive and interviewing the director of Take This Hammer. She realized the importance of this historic document, and she became curious about the history of Hunters Point. So, Caroline, why don't you talk to us about this project and the screening, which is going to happen at the Luggage Store Gallery on Tuesday, June 19th, which is also Juneteenth, a historic moment in African American and American history. It's the day that So why don't you talk about the film let's see. Well, we haven't been joined by any of the other subjects, but yeah, tell us about the film and then we'll let Mr. Locker reflect on that moment 50 years ago.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity of letting all of us be on the air to talk about this moment. You have to understand, I'm an outsider. I'm a foreigner. I come to San Francisco with certain cliches in my head about its progressive nature, about the summer of love, about beat poets, about a certain tolerance towards, it's the sort of the home and the birthplace of social change in the '60s. As far as I've learned in the history books. So when I was digging into the archive, the San Francisco Bay Television Archive, which houses all the KQED documentaries, KPIX, it's a jewel of a collection. And I had the chance to interview Richard O. Moore, who was a documentary director there for many years in the 50s. I saw one of his films, which was called Take This Hammer, and I realized that this was something that I had just never seen before, this side of San Francisco. I had just simply never learned about what it was like to be African-American and growing up during the Civil Rights Movement, because all the history books usually talk about the South and the blatant and open racism that was there. But San Francisco had always been kind of, known for the hippies and the progressiveness. And so while I was looking at that and seeing these very articulate young people voice their pain and voice the hopelessness and voice what they that they had no trust in the capacity of Martin Luther King at that time to make the change they wanted, I started to wonder, Hunters Point still is a place where a lot of the people tell me as a foreigner, it's a no-go zone. And so it's still a troubled neighborhood. And I wanted to understand better what is going on now by looking at the past. And looking at the history, I realized I really would like to meet these young people from then and ask them what happened and what it was like at that moment so that I could understand better what was going on now in San Francisco as far as the African-American community. And I figured that being an outsider in many ways, that was maybe something that could be accomplished. But I was only able to track down James Lockwood, for example, because of people like Oscar James, who has been playing an incredible role, I think, in the community for many, many years.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Lockett, we spoke at length yesterday about some of
yes.
the wonderful work that you've been doing. I mean, you are like, you're part of an organization called Black Men Speaks, African American Issues Committee. There's a mental health organization that you're a part of because you have a background in behavior health services. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and sort of what's been going on? I think when I was looking at the Caroline's new piece, that you ended up being incarcerated and then, you know, obviously you're not incarcerated anymore, and your son, you were telling me that your younger son, who turned 21 in October, is just got a life sentence. I wonder if you could talk about sort of then and now, and what was the pull? Why were you in that setting with James Baldwin in Hunters Point? Had you known him? Did some of your friends tell you, you know, you got to, you know, come see this man because, you know, he's a real forward thinker? What brought you to that particular gathering? And as you reflect on that, sort of what has changed? One of the things that I kept on hearing a lot was about the anger, you know, the anger that, you know, the young men were feeling.
That set us off.
Huh? Hmm?
The anger that set us off.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd like to say good morning, Caroline, and how are you?
Good, good. And you haven't seen the final piece yet, and you will.
Yeah. Well, the Oakland Post is waiting to see it. But to reflect back on what Wanda was saying, you know, what was happening 50 years ago and what's happening today is the same old side with a different dressing. And when I say that, to say this, some of the same same things are still going on. It's just in a new way with a new generation. And the new generation is a lot looser and wilder than we were. But it's still, for example, now they're doing some new redevelopment in Hunters Point in the Bay Area. You know, they're finna to do a lot of building and stuff. And again, it's on the news. The people of San Francisco had to, the people of Oakland, for example. And now the same thing that's happening in San Francisco is happening in Oakland just on a smaller level. For example, the Army base here, they had to go, the citizens of Oakland had to go to City Hall and demand that they hire 50% of Oakland people. Well, they did the same thing in Hunters Point. We did the same thing in Hunters Point back in the 60s when they started redeveloping Hunters Point. We were observing license plates from Montana, Wyoming, and Caucasians were coming in and getting work, and we weren't. But they were working in our neighborhoods and on our houses, and they really didn't have respect for us. So that fueled a lot of the anger, because we still had to, you know, a lot of our parents were single parents, single mothers, and with big families. And we were still subjected to having to live off of welfare and scrapping to make ends meet. A lot of kids were walking around with holes in their shoes where they had people coming from out of state working with brand new.
Hello? Oh, are you finished? Hello? Oh.
Maybe the connection was cut off?
Not that I can see. But If you are listening to me, Mr. Lockett, call back because we can't hear you anymore. So, Caroline, tell us about, as someone who is an outsider, some of the parallels that you saw between, you know, San Francisco then and San Francisco now when you were talking to, you know, some of the subjects, and how many men were you able to get in touch with?
I was able to get in touch actually with quite a surprising big group of people. I think I was able to contact at least six people, but in the end I had to, of course, just keep it a little bit simpler, and I thought that James Lockett, Tyron Primus, and Jackie Bell really were telling the story and giving the backstory of it in a very compelling way, and the way they are living their lives now also showed, I thought, was representative for the large group of African Americans that were able to extract their families out of the violence of Hunter's Point, but also in the case of James Lockett, the difficulty of getting stuck in this with seeing his child, who is now facing life without parole, sort of the continuous cycle of violence and getting into prison. And you asked about the parallel between then and now. The big parallel, I think, is that if you go to the project in Hunter's Point, and I have not spent excessive amounts of time in West Point, which is where I interviewed two very young, very intelligent, very bright young activists who are living in the project. What I realized was that back in 1963 and now again, Hunter's Point is a very geographically isolated place. And so the same problems that they faced back then of poverty and not having a future and not getting a chance and not getting a break continues now under a different, as James Lockett said, it's the same salad with a different sauce. It's not something I can totally vouch for, but I did feel that the young people now continue to have a hopelessness that James Baldwin in his film Take This Amber addresses and tries to infuse the young people with hope that you can become there's nothing that you cannot do, which a lot of the younger people, I think, to this day do not believe due to their economic situation.
Right. Yeah, I was when I was watching the film Take This Hammer, and I'm really happy that it's available. One can go to YouTube and find it, which is really great. I was just taking some notes, you know, as Baldwin, you know, took a tour of San Francisco first in the vehicle, then, you know, sat down in a variety of contexts and just talked to the community. And one could see how great a listener that he is, that he was. And I really, one of the moments in the conversation during his visit was the whole notion of paying one's dues. And he talks about the bill has come in, and the question is what we have in the bank. And that reminded me of Martin King's speech, the I Have a Dream speech. And one of those things he talked about, you know, the bank of, I'm not exactly certain the quote, but he talks about sort of the ethical bank, and that there's an outstanding note that people of African descent have already deposited, and it's been returned for insufficient funds, and we're depositing it again. And he talks, you know, about this nation, that this nation does have a debt to pay to people of African descent. And I just sort of reflected on that. And James Baldwin, being the brilliant man that he is, that he was, I'm sure he knew the reference too. So what do you think about that, paying one's dues? Or maybe you could talk about some other aspects of the film that really struck you as really powerful. I you know, thought about when James Baldwin mentioned the children dying here in California, in Northern California, San Francisco, and children dying in other places in this country. He talked about, people talked about the job situation, how there weren't enough jobs, and mothers were talking about how their children were going to the same schools as white children, yet when they graduated, they couldn't, they didn't have the same kind of opportunities for employment, which didn't make
right.
any sense. Yeah, and the whole thing around the black president, the Negro president, you know, sort of not letting your dreams be, you know, become squashed or negated.
Yeah, actually, you raise a number of points. As far as the dues being paid, I think it's a very interesting notion, and it's something that I feel that I can speak less to, just because I am a little bit of an outsider, and I don't mean it out of being careful, but I don't. It's something I would be interested to know how much that is a feeling that still holds on today for the African American community, just throughout the United States. How much they feel that dues haven't been paid. So that's like a question that I had. But while making this film, or a short doc, it's 10 minutes, around 10 minutes. One of the questions I had was, you know, what kind of racism did they face in San Francisco? What was the nature of it? And the reason I asked that was because in the South, it was such a, you know, people were hanging from trees. You know, it was so open, it was so blatant. And person after person that I interviewed would tell me, you know, the difficulty with San Francisco was that you didn't really know where you stood. It was not the schools were integrated, but they didn't advise us or encourage us to do anything that was, that would lead to a better future. It was being, you know, you'd become janitor, you could become a worker, a construction worker, but that was about it. I was kept on trying to figure out, so where did you encounter the walls of resistance in San Francisco? What were the examples? And there were many, but it was the subtlety of the discrimination that was in San Francisco just hit people in the same way as the blatant discrimination down in the South. And that really made me think, and it is also something I think that still may hurt the community today, because this discrimination has been passed on from generation to generation. So apart from maybe the Caucasians having to pay their dues, I think there's something even more important, is what James Baldwin wants the young African-Americans in the film to do, is to shake off this notion that you believe that you're not equal to the rest of the Caucasians, that you believe that you are less or inferior. And those thoughts of being inferior, I think, are really something that are tenacious. And they continue to pose the problems, I think, for a lot of the younger people growing up in the project in Hunters Point.
Yeah.
And that was just one of the feelings.
Caroline, we've been joined by Mr. Lockett is back. So, so you've been listening, I'm sure. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to have some input on this question of paying one's dues that I raised.
Yeah, well, in paying one's dues, let me say that again.
Remember in the film when James Baldwin, he talks about how the bill has come in, and the question is what we have in the bank. And he said that everyone that, you know, speaking metaphorically, that dues have to be paid, that one cannot just consume and take advantage and not pay dues. And so that's my interpretation. These are my words. So, if that's not something that resonates for you with regards to the film or when Baldwin was here, perhaps you could talk about something that resonated for you.
No, I can reflect on that. I can reflect on that.
Okay.
And paying one's dues, I found that coming from where I came from and the blessings that have been bestowed upon me, I took things in, and I had to, in one way, pay dues by being framed to incarceration. Even though I participated, I didn't do what they said I did. But in paying my dues, I'm trying to pay them now. I'm trying to give back to the people and give back to the community and to keep the next generation from having to suffer the hardships that me and my generation did. We've got three lost generations, my children, my children's children, and my great-grandchildren. Those are three lost generations, but I'm still alive to be able to help with my organization to try to ensure that somewhere down the line our people are saved, that all of, we don't have to continue, my grandchildren don't have to continue to suffer the plight that we're suffering. So it's a lot of hard work in this, in doing what I'm doing right now. It's a lot of hard work and a lot of sacrifice. And in that, I'm looking at that's paying my dues. But the Creator pays my wages for paying my dues. And to wake up fairly healthy, and alive and able to get up and function and think, where a lot of the people who I came up with are no longer here. It's just a blessing. And I owe it to the Creator, and I owe it to my children and your children and the children of those to come. So that's part of paying my dues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what another person seems and thinks about paying their dues is their own personal thing. But
right.
I'm paying my dues, and it looks like I'm going to be fall or wrong. I'm done. It looks like I'll forever be paying them. But
yeah.
I love paying them. I love doing what I'm doing.
It sounds like atonement. You know, the way you describe that. There was a. Caroline, do you have a comment?
On what James Lockhart is saying?
Yeah, did he just say it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think what he says is something heartfelt. I do think that the question more generally in the U.S. about, you know, did maybe the white Caucasian population pay their dues, I think that might be something that is still in the air. And something that in situations like Trayvon Martin come up again and shows that, you know, that these talking about race and the hurt that has been in the past is not yet over and needs to be touched upon. And we need to talk about it, continue talking about it. And I think that the way James Lockhart and Oscar James and all the other people able to talk to, I think that was something that we both really wanted to do, to talk about the most painful issue, which is the racism that a lot of people experienced at that time.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I just wanted to mention that the screening, are you going to be screening both films, The Baldwin and yours?
Yes, absolutely. Take This Hammer, it's not a light viewing. I mean, it is. He talks a lot, as you mentioned, Wanda. But I really recommend everybody to see this film, because I think a lot of it really is, it is not dated. I think his message still holds on to today, even though there's an African-American president. He still has a lot of words of encouragement and reflection. So his film, that film is the prime thing to come to see. My piece on this is just furthering the discussion on what it is also, what happened to the people in the film, such as with James Lockett, and also to reflect on what's going on today. And there will be a Q&A moment, and I am going to invite all the people that were in the film to speak, to answer questions from the audience, of, and probably many of them will also reflecting on what is going on today and what can be done.
Right, that'll be awesome. I want to mention that the Luggage Store Gallery is located at 1007 Market Street in San Francisco. It's between
1007.
Yeah, Market Street, and it's between the Civic Center BART station and the Powell Street BART station. It's not really like right across the street from either one, but it's between the two, and it's not wheelchair accessible. So if you're in a wheelchair, you can't get up the stairs. It's very steep. And the phone number there is area code 415-255-5971, 255-5971, 415 area code. And the program starts, I believe, at 7. Is that correct, Caroline?
Absolutely, that is correct.
And it's a free event.
Exactly. It's a free event. And not to worry, James, I will call you as soon as I get back from Mexico, and I'll give you all the details.
Yeah, and people should bring young people to the screening. It will really be I think have a tremendous impact on their lives. And I was speaking to another one of your subjects yesterday, and he called, but he called a little earlier, and he might have had to work. Trying to think, what is his name?
Tyrone.
Yeah, Tyrone. Right. Yeah, he called in. He called at 8 at the wrong time, and we are out of time right now. But he was mentioning that a lot of times young people don't get out of their neighborhoods because of some of the gang activity. Like if they go from, like if they're in Kirkwood, they can't travel to Paloo. If they're on Paloo, they can't travel to another street.
West Point.
I'm like, wow, that's horrible. And so, so I was suggesting that maybe, you know, there be a vehicle that didn't have windows, so that a person could get transported outside of the community, and nobody would know who's in the vehicle. So hopefully things will work out. And some kids from Hunters Point in particular, maybe Hunters Point will be able to make it to the screening in Fillmore and all the other areas and just see, you know, the significance of this historic moment almost 50 years ago. And James Baldwin as a true visionary, and these men, you know, young men at that time and elders now, and the significance of their realizing the importance of this moment and coming together and voicing their ideas and feelings about, you know, justice and human rights in San Francisco.
And one last word. Mm-hmm. It would be so important to invite people from Oakland, especially West Oakland, mm-hmm. is going through the same things that Hunters Point went through. Hunters Point got the Naval Shipyard. Oakland got the Army base. Mm-hmm. But it's the same equation that's going on. And it would be so nice that people from Oakland would be invited to. And if one of you ladies would call my chairman of the board, Paul Cobb, who's the owner of the Oakland Post, of the Post newspaper group, and invite him, so that this can get some publicity outside of just Carolyn, and people will have a better idea of what's going on. It would really be wonderful.
Well, I'm gonna put it right back on you, Mr. Lockett. You call Mr. Cobb and tell him how important
okay.
this is, and you bring some people from Oakland because you and I both are in Oakland, and.
Yeah.
And I think it's really significant that it happened in San Francisco, so the folks in San Francisco definitely need to be there, but that is not excluding the greater Bay Area, you know, definitely not.
Yeah.
Because what what the young people, yourself included, talked about, it echoes presently. And as we think about Juneteenth, we think about freedom, we think about the liberation of our people, people of African descent, we think about reparations, repairing the damage. You know, moments like this are really important, you know, as triggers to discuss where we are, where we've been, and where we want to go. So thank you so much, Caroline, for the film and for the interest and for doing this. I really appreciate it, and we really appreciate it. And safe journey, safe travels from Mexico back to California. And thank you so much, Mr. Locke, for joining us today.
And what time will the screening be?
It's at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
I emailed you everything, Mr. Locke, yesterday. So check your email.
7 p.m.?
I emailed you everything, Mr. Locke. Check your email, okay?
Okay. Well, you know, I'm somewhat computer illiterate.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll work on
that. I will contact you soon.
I got it, though. I got everything.
Okay. All right. You all take good care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care and have a good trip, a safe trip. And watch out for the bandits, Carolyn. Take care, Wanda.
You too. Peace and blessings.
All right. And
good morning. How are you?
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for hanging in there.
No problem.
Yeah.
That was great. I caught the end of it, but that was really great. It sounds like there's just a lot of great community events going on that it's really nice to have this show to let everybody know about them.
Right. And I'm so happy that you could join us. How do you pronounce it? Kasika Kumar?
Rasika Kumar.
Rasika Kumar. What a pretty name.
Thank you.
And, of Apinaya?
Apinaya.
I'm just killing everything.
No problem.
And San Jose Taiko. And you're going to be, you're participating in the 34th Annual Ethnic Dance Festival. How exciting.
Yes, very.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've got this piece that you've collaborated. You've got, you know, Indian or South Asian and Japanese combined, and the piece is called Synergy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could tell us about the piece, and then I will, you know, read what you sent me about the company.
Sure, no problem. So I'm part of the Abhinaya Dance Company, and what we do is a style of dance called Bharatanatyam. It's classical Indian dance from South India. It originated in the temples of South India, so over 2,000 years ago. So it's a very ancient art form, and it retains such a connection to the religion and the culture and the spirituality of Hinduism, and that still is there in the way that we perform today. It's still very rooted in spirituality and mythology and religion. And San Jose Taiko is also they're a company in the Bay Area. They've been performing Taiko for several years. I think they were started in 1973. They've also been performing Taiko for a very long time. And over the years, they've also incorporated other different elements that are non-Japanese, but mostly they also adhere to the same kind of idea of the spirituality and connection and community that we, Bharatanatyam dancers, also value. So back in 1993, both our companies collaborated for the first time, and it was probably one of the first multicultural collaborations in the Bay Area at that time. You know, there were not too many. Everybody was just kind of like starting off and growing, and this is a great, great event. And in 2010, my mother, who's the artistic director of Abhinaya, she wanted to reconnect with San Jose Taiko and see what we could come up with, you know, as a new collaboration. So myself and Franco Imperial, who's the artistic director of San Jose Taiko now, we came together and we just started talking, and it's like, okay, well, what do we want to do? How do we want to, you know, Indian dance, Japanese Taiko? Like, what can we even do with this? And we came up with a lot of ideas about spirituality and connection and community, and in the end, we wanted something fun. So taking all those ideas together, we put together what I call a conversation. It's not fusion, but it's a conversation, and it ends up being a really exciting interplay between Bharatanatyam dancers and our South Indian classical musicians and the Japanese taiko drummers and performers. And we go back and forth, but we also unite at the end, and it's just like a really fun exploration of rhythm, exploration of movement, and we just have so much energy on stage. So that's what synergy is for us.
Wow, wow. So talk about the interplay of the music between the two ensembles.
Mm-hmm. So when we first started, we knew we'd have to kind of understand each other's rhythmic vocabulary first. So we started just like jamming around, playing around, and it turns out rhythm is so universal in so many ways. I mean, like every culture has some rhythmic music in it, in most cultures of the world. And you don't have to look very hard to find similarities in how people express themselves in rhythm. And this was really exciting for us, because then what we ended up doing was, in one segment, I composed several rhythmic sequences for Bharatanatyam, and then I taught it to Franco for him to interpret in taiko, and vice versa. He taught me some taiko compositions, then I interpreted in Bharatanatyam dance. So there was an exchange of rhythmic sequences, and then we also talked about, okay, how do we kind of make this feel like a conversation? So we worked really hard on the interaction between the performers, on not making it static, where most people come and they're like, okay, well, if you have Bharatanatyam and taiko, well, the dancers are dancing on one side, the drummers are in the back on the other side. That was what we did not want at all. We wanted everybody to be moving around each other, connecting, interacting, you know, sharing rhythms at the same time, and just a completely dynamic experience.
Yeah, I was just reading a bit about the type of dance that your company performs, and it says that it's a classical form from the South Indian state of Tamil Nadu,
mm-hmm.
practiced primarily in modern times by women.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
That is true, though there are several male dancers that are up and coming. I don't know. I think it just is kind of like, again, stereotypes of, you know, men don't want to dance, and so therefore, especially in this age and in this community that I've grown up with, a lot of young boys aren't encouraged to dance, which I think is a real shame, because, you know, it is not at all limited to women. And in fact, a lot of the older masters have learned from are all male. And so it definitely is a universal dance form, can be danced by women, people of all ages. So it's just whatever cultural influences that have led it to only be performed by women in recent times.
Okay. Yeah, and it said that, you know, the inspirations come from the sculptures of the ancient temple of Chidambaram.
Yeah, Chidambaram.
Yeah, Chidambaram. And I was just wondering if you could talk about sort of the influence of visual art and sculpture on composition, as well as because when I think about Southern India, I think about some of the African heritage, the people of African descent, the connection between South Asia and
mm-hmm.
Africa, and the I'm trying to think of the non-derogatory term. The Siddhi. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Just about the visual art and the sculptures?
And the people.
And the people. Sure. Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because I'll just talk about the sculptures first and then continue. But the sculptures that you see in Indian temples throughout India are actually of dancers. So we have this treatise called the Natya Shastra, which was written over 2,000 years ago, and that delineates all the movements that we can use in dance, in all classical dance. And Bharatanatyam is just one of, I believe, eight classical dance forms of India. And they all refer and borrow, I mean, not borrow, but are derived from this one treatise, the Nati Shastra. So all the sculptures that you see in the temples are actually of dancers and of these movements. And they've actually served, in some cases, as a reference point. When over the years, if dance has dance masters are too few, or dance has taken up a bad reputation, and so nobody's really learning it, and the traditions are dying out, then actually people have gone back to the sculptures to reconstitute what that particular dance form may have looked like. So the sculptures in the temples are incredibly important, both as a religious symbol of, you know, and a venue for where this dance was performed and where it was, you know, continued throughout the years, but also the sense of, you know, keeping that heritage alive and a record of what this was in past times. So we have a very strong connection with the temples. I'm not too familiar with kind of the different cultures that have come about in South India in terms of what you were referring to. I'm actually born and raised in America, so I'm actually born and raised in California. So for me, like, the community here is really my community, and when we go back to India, we go back and we learn from masters of Indian dance there, which I guess one interesting thing is, historically, the dancers, when they learned, they were actually servants of the temple, and they were called Devadasis. And this was not something that just everybody desired to do. They didn't just bring their daughters to the temple and said, here, you know, you can have my daughter. So it was something that very, very rare and very prestigious at one time. And then that kind of declined in prestige. And so now, in the 1950s, there was one dancer, Rukmini Devi Arundel, who basically, she was an upper-class lady who decided that she was going to learn this art form, which at the time was completely it had a very bad reputation, so nobody wanted to learn it. But through her work and through all her her effort and studying and research, she pretty much brought the art form back to life. And what we see today is a result of her kind of bringing it to the world. And therefore, a lot of, I'm sure many people are aware of the caste system in India. So a lot of the upper caste people are actually learning it, whereas in the past, they weren't the people who originally learned it. So that's kind of an interesting tidbit about the history of this dance and how it had a revival in the 20th century.
Right. Yeah, that is really interesting. And our other guest, Naomi Duff, has joined us. Do you know Naomi Duff, artistic director of Diamantakora?
Oh, I've seen your company perform. I don't think we've met personally.
Okay. Well, good morning, Naomi. You have an opportunity to say hi to one of your fellow choreographers.
Well, good morning. Good morning.
I want to let the audience know that both companies are going to be performing closing weekend of the 34th annual Ethnic Dance Festival. It's really, really exciting, and that's June 30th and July 1st. Is that also at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in the theater?
Yes.
Okay, super, super. Last question for you is, I was wondering, as an artist, you know, who was, you know, born here,
mm-hmm.
How has dance helped you in sort of affirming your bicultural person?
Oh, it's been completely integral to me having that kind of bicultural identity. What I love about dance, and what I think a lot of Indian people in this community are also, what they also like about dance, is that it's not just a movement vocabulary. it, for us, it is a complete cultural and religious experience. And through the art form, when you're from when you start it, you're learning about our history, you're learning about mythology, you're learning about the religion and spirituality and discipline and a whole range of things. And it's really keeping in touch with your culture in a way that some other dance forms don't have that scope. And so it's been really important for me to as a way to keep in touch with my culture, with my religion. And I think what's great is that here in the Bay Area is such a it's such a great place. We have such a great Indian community in the Bay Area, very knowledgeable, a lot of people coming, bringing in new art forms and just a lot of very talented people here. So we're able to keep up the art form at a very high standard and keep producing art and keep that connection alive to our traditions.
Super, super. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Rasika Kumar, for joining us to talk about Synergy, which is going to be performed closing weekend at the 34th Annual Ethnic Dance Festival. And I was wondering if you can give our audience your website for those who are interested in, you know, finding out more about the company or perhaps taking classes.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you so much. Our website is abhinaya.org. That's abhinaya.org. And we are collaborating with San Jose Taiko, and that is Taiko. Their website is taiko.org, which is taiko.org. So visit both our sites, and you'll get information about the Ethnic Dance Festival and our performance at both sites.
Okay, super. Well, thanks again. I look forward to seeing you the week after next.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, you take good care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, good morning, Mama Naomi. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Wonderful to be with you again. Yes.
Yeah, you are. It's so wonderful having you on. I'm so happy that you're able to grace our air in our studio with your presence. And that Diamana Kora is West African Dance Company is once again a part of the San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival. Wow. How many ethnic dance festivals do you go back with? I mean, do you go all the way back to the first one 34 years ago? Because I know you are regularly, one of the companies.
Well, you know, I've lost track, but it's been many years. You know, I feel like we are part of the fabric of the San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival, you know. And, I mean, we are just always so thrilled, you know, to be a part of such a, you know, memorable, you know, a landmark, you know, actually experience in the Bay Area. And for, you know, I call it for Bay Area, you know, dance music enthusiasts. So, I mean, it's just so wonderful. Yes.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's really great. There's so many young people throughout the Bay Area, whether that is the Ailey Camp or Berkeley High's, you know, dance program or, you know, coming Laney College. or your own classes that you teach regularly every Saturday. What time is it, at 3?
Right. 2:30 to 4.
2:30 to 4. Yeah. How many years have you had that slot?
Oh my goodness, that's the 80s. Really?
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. And you know, your own children have grown up in the company, and they've gone away to university and come back to visit and doing great things.
In fact, my daughter is graduating today, you know, actually, and I'm calling from the graduation rehearsal. I took a time away to come and do this. I think it was very important. So, my youngest is graduating today from Berkeley High School. Yeah.
Oh, wow, that is amazing. Wow. And then have the opportunity to speak to one of your daughter who is in New Orleans.
Right, Isalama,
yeah. She's making a film about her father, right?
Yes, her grandfather, yes.
Her grandfather, right, yes. Yeah. And then your one of your sons, he went to Florida. Is he still there?
Oh yes, my son, the dancer. Yeah,
dancer, great teacher.
Fashion design at the Miami Institute. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so, but they are all still in art, so that is such a great thing, you know. And I can really, you know, say I'm blessed with that they have, you know, they learn the tradition and to still carry on the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Certainly.
So it's a good thing. Yes.
Right, yeah. And, see, you have a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology and a minor in African History from the University of California, San Diego. And I'm just reading this from your website, which is DMO.
Right, and I have a Master's in Organization Management also.
Oh, nice. Where's that
from? And I increased my credential, yes.
Oh, from where?
Well, my teaching credential is from Patton University. My master's is from University of Phoenix.
Oh, nice. Well, you should add that to your bio.
That's true. Okay, I will. Yes.
Yeah. So tell us about this piece that you are. I believe that either it's a new piece or it's something that the curators of the 34th. Season have requested. So what is Diamantacora bringing to the festival this year?
Well, this year we're bringing an exciting piece that represents the culture of Liberia, West Africa. Mm-hmm. And it is from the Loma ethnic group, and it's called the Breaking of the Sandy Bush. And what it is, you know, for people to understand is that, you know, a lot with many African traditions, especially in West Africa, young people have to go through, I mean, here they know it's a rites of passage. People call it, you know, debutante, you know, the quinceanera, you know, with the Hispanic. But they have to go through a traditional school. And for us, really, if you think about it, it is part of the formal education. And what they are trained by a selected group of elders. And in traditional time, the older time, they would leave their family for up to 7 years. And they would be trained in every aspect of the society, what the community expected of them, how they would lead productive life. And it was more the thing to teach them to be progressively functioning members of society. And at the end, they will come out and show what they have learned, and they will be returned to the family. So they will come out, the bodies are decorated in white chalk as a sign of purity. They wear special beads for protection on their waist and across their chest. They wear the yarn to show that, you know, in the society, things are made from, you know, nature itself, because it's understanding that this is what God has provided. And so they have this hand-woven yarn skirt that they wear. And so the Sandy is a society for young girls in Liberia. The male have the society also, and it's called the Poro Society. And what it is that they are separate, is that the education of males and females should be separate when they have learned about themselves and they have developed their identity. And then they are able to come together because each group respectively have developed their self-identity and they have become so strong, then society has no problem. So this is what we are bringing to the San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival. It's a very rich culture from Liberia. It also encompasses also the mass, because in these initiations, there are deities that also bless and cleanse. And so we have three masked dances that are going to be a part of this festival. And masks are very, you know, we bring the mask because it's something rare that the American audience does not have a chance to see. And so it is also exciting in itself that we actually transporting what I want to say, the tradition of Liberian society of the Loma onto the stage of the San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival. And so people get to be right there, and they, that experience alone is really rare and unique. That will not be experienced by anyone, even probably if, in their lifetime, if they did not travel to Africa.
Wow. So you're saying that it's happening right now, this what you're going to be sharing with us, this ritual initiation, it happens on the continent.
Yes.
Right now, today.
Yes, today it happens. Mm-hmm. But you'll have to, you're not seeing it in the city. You
mm-hmm.
have to go, and we say we have to go. You have to go in the interior.
Uh-huh.
So that means you have to go way outside of the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yes.
Yeah, it seems like it's probably getting really hard for there to even be an interior nowadays with, you know, with different technological advancements in the most rural area, there's a possibility to have, you know, a cyber connection with a cell phone, or, you know, which means you have internet. So why, could you talk a little bit, because I know you have to get to this graduation, about the importance of maintaining certain types of cultural practices even as society moves forward? Why is it important to hold on to these traditions?
Because it's a way to keep the society, you know, whole. It's a way of keeping the new generation connected to, I will call it a foundation that really create some type of, I would say, a semblance for the entire world, you know, because as technology takes over the interior, you know, you still have people who are very strong in Kenya. And there is a great debate about, you know, evolution of even traditional, you know, practices. And it does happen, and that's why I say people have to go to the interior, because in the interior, that is so far removed from the city, right? And even though there's technology, you have the cell phone and whatnot, there is still, you know, that idea of nature. There is still that idea of mingling, you know, creating, maintaining this harmony with nature, because that's what it is, and people still, they are very, very conscious about, okay, this is what the tradition is. We want to make sure we keep it. And what is very helpful, you know, in countries too, especially in Liberia, is that the government is making sure that these traditions in the interior are maintained, you know. And so that's why the National Cultural Center comes in, and they also have, you know, traditional centers in the interior, and they make a conscious effort to let the people know we want to maintain the tradition because it is the fabric of the society, regardless of what development happens. You know, we have to maintain this because this is who we are, and it's very crucial for our young people.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and you know, as in thinking about sort of, you know, this is Juneteenth month. I mean, every weekend there's somewhere in the Bay Area that Juneteenth is being celebrated. This weekend it's San Jose and San Francisco,
right.
And
right.
And one thinks about, you know, June 18, 1865, when the Texans, African people of African descent in Texas, got the news that the Civil War was over and that they were free. And one thinks about sort of, you know, the cultural disconnect between people in the African diaspora and the continent, and in companies like Diamantakora that brings back, you know, these traditions and teaches it to the children of the children,
right.
of the children of the children.
Right.
And in
the
connection, you know, of your country, you know, Liberia, to
right.
to this country and to that history. And I said that was the last comment, the other one, but one more.
That's okay. That's okay. That's okay. you know, one of the things I know when I mention people, you know, they ask, oh, wait, you're from a detective accent, you know, and I'd say I'm from Liberia the first, and they say, oh, you are like us, you know, because, you know, of, you know, the American colonization society and its connection to, you know, taking, you know, people from here, returning them back to Africa. And I tell them, I say, oh, yes, of course, you know, there is that connection, but don't forget also there were people there before the indigenous population was there. And so it makes it an important thing, you know, because people understand, okay, there is a direct tie actually between Liberia and, you know, African Americans here because of that journey that happened. But also, and also understanding that, hey, we have a grip on some type of cultural tradition. So when I come to teach about, you know, this tradition from Africa, it's easier for me because of that connection, you know, and I can say, you know, say to especially the young people, look, you know, there is a transport that happened between Africa and America a long time ago when, you know, the end of the Civil War, you know, and people went back to Liberia, people went to Sierra Leone, and of course, if they were in Liberia and Sierra Leone, they were also able to travel to other countries. So, and this is something that hasn't been talked about a lot. There are people that have migrated from Liberia and Sierra Leone to other countries from the United States. And that would be something for historians really to kind of focus on to see how far people actually spread out from the left, you know, America to go back to Africa to make a home for themselves. But it makes it easier to teach the tradition here because there is that connection. Between us.
Definitely there's a connection between us. And,
yeah.
And I just really love that, you know, you have been a true mother to our community in, you know, so far as, you know, bringing the culture and nurturing us, you know, on, you know, on different sides of the Atlantic, and also, you know, coming from our different traditions, honoring the traditions that have come, you know, from being, you know, 400 years, 500 years now in the diaspora, as well as reconnecting us with other traditions that, you know, we, for all intents and purposes, probably don't remember in our, you know, what, you know, in our conscious. But we probably, what I know we remember on another level, on a soul level, on a DNA level. And art is certainly a healing, transformative practice, particularly dance and music and, you know, learning those, you know, letting those drums sort of work their magic, you know.
Right.
It's just really fabulous. Yeah. And then, you know, your family and, you know, with your husband who is from another place in Africa and has another tradition. And, you know, you're just like, we are the world in your own family.
Yes, yes, yes. And this is the world we try to bring to the stage to actually share with others.
Right.
You know, because we say the tradition does not belong to us. It was actually, we are just the instrument to pass it on to the world. And that's what we do on stage. And, you know, that's what we are going to do, you know, the weekend of June, you know, 30th and July 1st. And it's such a wonderful time because this is also, we are bringing to the world, because this is also the conference of Dance USA. During that, you know, starting from Thursday and going on to Monday of that week. So I think it's such a fantastic thing that the San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival is happening at the same time as, you know, Dance USA, and we are going to be a part of that whole, you know, event that is going to occur that week, and it's going to be exciting. And one of the things is, say, boy, how often do you get Dance USA and San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival happening at the same time? So people would do themselves a great, and it's a historic moment, you know, to really be a part of the festival that weekend. And I know I understand tickets are going so fast, you know, so people really want to jump on and call, you know, because it is an exciting weekend.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks for telling us. Well, I hadn't known about Dance USA also being, you know, that weekend as well. Oh, that's awesome.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yes. And they have a series of conferences and whatnot throughout San Francisco.
Okay. Well, that should be fun. That should really be fun. Great. Why don't you give our audience your website so people can stay in touch with what Diamana Cora is doing?
Oh, please do. Diamanocura.org. Simply put the company full name, .org. And, of course, we have a repertory concert coming November, Thanksgiving weekend every year.
Yeah.
And then we have a big festival in March of the Diaspora Dance, representing all cultures of the African diaspora, with about 17 guest teachers from the continent, you know, and that's the second weekend of March, March 7th to the 10th. So
okay.
Please join us. But again, diamanocura.org.
Right. Yes. And also I wanted to let our audience know that I had the privilege of teaching one of your sons, Stefan, a few years ago when he graduated. And is he finished yet? I think he was at Cal State East Bay, right?
Yes, he is graduating tomorrow.
Oh, my God.
Yes,
oh, tell him, give him a hug. Tell him congratulations. Wow.
Yes, and moving on to Howard University. And this
Ooh.
Is something we also encourage as well.
Nice.
That when the young people join us, education is first and foremost because it is the option of success.
Right.
You know, and then we try to encourage them to go on for, you know, higher degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a great accomplishment. He's graduating and others are behind him.
Oh,
yes.
That's awesome. That is so cool. Wow,
yes,
wow.
Congratulations to Stefan. Yes, he did
yeah.
it.
Yeah, wow. That is really, really fantastic. Oh, well, tell him congratulations and stay in touch.
Yes,
wow.
Thank you. I shall
well, congratulations, know. Mama and Naomi. Wow, two children graduating in the same weekend, one today and one tomorrow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
What a busy weekend. And tell tell Baba Zach I said Happy Father's Day.
I sure will. And thank you so much, Wanda, for doing this for us, for exposing, you know, traditional arts, you know, to the public, for them hearing, you know, what we do and, you know, how valuable it is. So
oh, you're welcome. Well, you take good care.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
Bye. So we're going to close our interview. This is Juneteenth weekend. This is also San Francisco Black Film Festival weekend, and it kicks off tonight. Well, yesterday was a pre-sort of kickoff. I don't know if anyone was able to get out to the Jazz Heritage Center, where there was a screening of a couple of films and some beverages, and there was also sort of reception also yesterday evening. But you can visit the sfbff.org to find out all the information about the San Francisco Black Film Festival, which is going to be showing great films from tonight at opening night at the Lorraine Hansberry Theater, 450 Bush, and Red Carpet, 7 o'clock. Robert Townsend is in town to kick off the festival and show his wonderful film, Hive. What's it called? Hive. Let me check my notes. I think. Oh no, it's called In the Hive. I saw a preview of it. You can actually go on YouTube and watch a preview. But it looks really, really. Really phenomenal, and is starring all of the great black folks that you have grown to love, like Loretta Devine. And it's based on a true story. So that should be really exciting. So that's tonight at the Lorraine Hansberry Theater. The San Francisco Black Film Festival kicks off. And I didn't get a chance to get by Mary Elizabeth in for the happy hour yesterday. It was happy hour to end homelessness. That sounds really interesting. And she's located at the Infusion Lounge, 124 Ellis Street. So that should be interesting. I have to check her out. And also there's going to be a wonderful Father's Day tribute and screening of films, and there's going to be a chef, a cook-off with a chef, the Oakland Museum chef and his son, and it's going to be a gospel choir. That's going to really be cool. And then there are films at the Jazz Heritage Center on Saturday. There are films at the African American Art and Culture Complex. Leo Sullivan's going to be leading a workshop. The following day, our guest, whose interview I'm going to play for you, she is going to be giving a workshop, and her name is Kimberly Bryant, and she's got an organization called Black Girls Code, CODE. And this particular festival, we're looking a lot at technology and different types of communication, particularly cyber communication and the whole gaming thing, the games that, you know, young people are playing, but, you know, thinking about making games with conscious. And Leo Sullivan is coming out this month with an application looking at Red Tails, the story of the Tuskegee Airmen, the film. There's actually going to be a game with an application that's going to be available this month, June. So access to technology, you know, sort of erasing the digital divide, and why technology is important and how we can use that to benefit ourselves and our community. That's sort of what Kimberly and I talk about. And again, the workshop that she's hosting on Sunday is a free workshop. You just need to register in advance. So visit San Francisco Black Film Festival, and it's the acronym .org for all the details. So here is Kimberly Bryant. Yeah, wow. I just love the name, Black Girls Code. It just sounds so intriguing.
Thank you.
And your website is so hot. I mean, I just love it. Seriously, I just love the colors, the pinks and the greens, and it's just, and then on the background of, you know, that the grays and black scheme. Really
mm-hmm.
nice, and your visuals are nice too, of the girls getting connected.
Yeah,
and I just love your you know, talking about sort of the genesis of this organization. And it's not even that old. You just started it like what, a year ago?
We did. We actually started in April 2011, and we had our very first class in the fall of last year.
Mm. Wow.
So still
yeah.
very, very, very new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about you and the other two partners, and sort of, you know, you were sitting in your, what, engineering class, looking around and not seeing yourself?
Oh, no, not quite engineering class. It's been a long time since I graduated from engineering school. So I did absolutely, you know, have that experience through engineering school as well as through my career
mm-hmm.
as an electrical engineer. So I found myself around the end of 2010 wanting to leave corporate America where I have worked for many, many years in the biotech and pharmaceutical field as an electrical engineer, and to go out on my own and start up my own business, really focus on the startup technology that's just been really booming, especially in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started to go to many different events and do a lot of networking, I found that over and over again, I was the only woman of color in the room, and, you know, also many times also the only person of color, period, in mm-hmm. a sea of folks. And after a while, you know, the first time you kind of notice it, but after the second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth time,
mm-hmm.
you start to say, well, maybe there's an issue here that I need to take a step back and take a look at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how it happened. And, you know, during the course of those meetings and really kind of talking to folks in the field of startup and technology about the, you know, tremendous lack of diversity and folks of color, I just really felt a strong need to take a bit of a detour and really focus my efforts and my energy on making a difference, so changing that equation and really introducing girls to the opportunities that, you know, were right here in our backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about your first year. How many girls, you know, came through your program, and how many have you, you know, connected to, you know, the digital industry and, you know, connected them to the possibilities that are not always visible, literally.
Yeah, literally. So we started out with a plan to do a pilot program at the end of 2011, and we really wanted to keep it small, so we were like, well, we'll only start out with six girls and, you know, six to eight, that'll be enough to really let us test out this idea and see how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And we tripled that during our pilot program. So we had, you know, tripled that amount coming through our program during the pilot. So we were like, oh, we're on to something here. So we went through the end of the year, and we, you know, we kind of tweaked some of our model and our ideas on how we would deliver our classes. And when we came into, oh, that was in the end of last year, the end of 2011. And when we came into this year, the beginning of 2012, a software consulting company, national company called ThoughtWorks, approached us about helping us to grow and expand our program,
nice.
Which we were tremendously excited about. And they really gave us the resources in terms of the facilities and their employees to help us launch our classes right in many ThoughtWorks offices, both here in San Francisco as well as Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So we have started to see some exponential growth as a result of that partnership and really the word of what we're doing getting out. So we have a class. We're doing a huge summer code activity program this summer where we have a goal to reach more than 300 girls and boys of color
mm-hmm.
and teach them programming. And the class that we have, we have a first, very first class in that series coming up on the 17th, or this weekend, during the Juneteenth Festival. And the class we have on the 30th of June is sold out in like a week and a half to 2 weeks. So we have more than 50 girls registered for that class alone.
Nice, yeah. And you mentioned Chicago, so are you San Francisco and Chicago, or San Francisco Bay Area? And so where are you all, you know, where is Black Girl Code, you know, conducting these workshops? Who's your constituency presently?
Well, we definitely feel that San Francisco and the Bay Area is our home.
Mm-hmm.
So it will always be our home base. But we have had requests from literally everywhere. So part of our goal during our Summer of Code campaign is to help us start to plant some seeds so that we can grow to other cities. The very first one we did was Chicago. We launched there in May because we wanted to kind of connect and utilize our partnership with ThoughtWorks. That's where their corporate office is located. So we launched our first class in Chicago in May. And we have other cities on our radar, which we will be doing workshops in this summer, as well as hoping to expand in the fall. And those include Atlanta, New York. We want to expand to L.A. We want to look at, as well, expanding to Detroit and a few other cities.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do these workshops, one day and two-day workshops in some of these cities this summer, and really hope that be a catalyst for launching an ongoing program in those areas in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about what you plan on doing at the your workshop at the San Francisco Black Film Festival this Saturday, I believe, right?
We are actually doing our workshop on Sunday.
Oh, it's Sunday. Okay.
Sunday for us in this lineup of with the Urban Game Suite. And we will be doing a class on Kodu programming. And Kodu is a software that allows kids to develop games on their own that they can actually take and play on the Xbox. So it's a really cool software tool that really gets them engaged, even if they have no programming experience before, to really quickly be able to create their own games. You know, we know that gaming is tremendously huge with both the girls and the boys these days. So we're always looking at ways to tap into the things that interest them the most and use that to teach them a skill that they can use to do, you know, bigger and other things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and that's going to happen on the 17th, which is also Father's Day.
Yes,
10 in the morning to 3 p.m., and boys and girls ages 10 to 16. And it's a free workshop, and folks just need to register in advance, right?
That's exactly right. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
Register in advance and come out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I was wondering. You probably get this question a lot with regards to helping, you know, young people become more adept at navigating cyberspace. You know, from building a web page in a day, which is your sold out, you know, June 30th workshop, to just becoming familiar with the possibilities. And then you have the kids writing code, you know, learning these alternative languages so they can really be masters of this environment, you know, not trying to speak English in an environment that has other type of, you know, protocols,
right.
Linguistic protocols, which are, a lot of times are based in mathematics, mm-hmm. but you see a real application for that. But on the downside, it's, you know, having everyone having access to this environment where you could be alone, you know, physically alone, but connected to so many other folks on the other side of their silos. So.
Okay. I know where you're going.
Yeah, so, you know, we're talking about, you know, community and if African people are relationship people. And I, of course, you know, I definitely understand that, you know, we need to redefine what community means. But then, you know, since we are, you know, tangible, you know, beings and we do have this empirical experience, what do you say to people like, okay, well, you know, like, what about learning how to communicate in real time? Like, are certain things sort of sacrificed when your only mode of communication with other people and the people that you know are via technology?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you could be right next to a person, but instead of talking to them, you'd be texting them. Because I've seen that.
Yeah,
and then as an English professor, I teach English at one of the community colleges here in the East Bay. And a lot of times composition is sacrificed through brevity, and people forget how to write because they're used to, you know, writing in commercials.
No, I know. I have to catch myself because as engineers, we tend to have a bad rap for our writing skills and our English mastery anyway. But I think that because technology and the STEM expertise is going to really be such a tremendous impact on future growth opportunities, future job opportunities, it's
mm-hmm.
imperative that we have our kids have those skills, but not at the expense of other skills as well. So, technology interfaces with math, but it also interfaces with art.
Mm-hmm.
It also interfaces with English. It is a language, although it's a different language than what we would speak,
mm-hmm.
but you still have to sell an idea. So the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Steve Jobs, you know, they have to sell that idea for the company once it's coded. So you can't do that if you can't speak. You don't know how to pitch your idea. You don't know how to communicate. And I think the most successful engineers are actually the ones that have strong communication skills. So that's one of the things that we do try to really focus on in our programs, that we're not just teaching a one-dimensional tool of being able to code, but really focusing on the full child, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
everything that will make that person full and a self-sufficient human being. And that's more than just being able to write a line of Python code.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you communicate with others. That's how you work in groups and teams, which we do in mostly all of our classes. So those things we do feel is necessary. And I think that, though, because those demographics are changing, you know, in very short time, what we think are minorities now, we won't be the minorities anymore. You know, we will be the actual majority population. So how do you make that majority population the most self-sufficient, skilled workforce and, you know, contributors as possible? And that's what we're trying to do.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. I as you were speaking, I certainly agree with everything that you said. And I was thinking, I saw this film, and I don't remember the name of the film, but it was in the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival maybe 2 years ago now. And the film was looking at, you know, these relationships that we have, these cyber relationships that we have, you know, like via Facebook and Twitter and MySpace and Facebook in particular, looking at, you know, your friends and then your friends of friends and to the way you categorize your relationships. And what they did is this woman was sort of in this film, she was talking about her father, who was a scientist, but also looking at her work and her husband's work with looking at digital media. And so she did a map, and she sort of like had these lines connecting, you know, this one person, like let's say you or me, you know, to all of these other people that we were connected with because they were connected to other people. And then she was talking about how in the film, and I think it's really important too, how, what are we doing with these relationships, like how it could be maximized to really bring some kind of change, like positive change to a particular issue that is of global concern, because this map was a global map.
Right.
And like, for instance, okay, we're interested in, let's say, the depletion of non-renewable resources. Mm-hmm. And because we're connected to all these folks, and then I read this other book, I'll get the name for it for you before we finish our conversation. And so we're looking at these, I forgot what it's called, but you have these groups that you're a part of, and you might not know everyone there, but the reason why you're connected is because you feel the same way about a particular issue. Mm-hmm. and there was a name for that. There's a technical name for it, but I don't know what it is. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's a similar type of grouping that when you go to a website like Amazon, they make a recommendation based on what you bought that you would like this too.
Right.
Yeah, only this is like you would like this too, but you would also like this person who's connected to the same type of issue or concern that you're connected to. So then you have this other community that's connected, mm-hmm. because the computer is able to match those kind of things pretty easily. And so I was wondering, I don't know if you're doing it now, but as you work with you know, these girls in particular, but the boys too, you know, folks that might not necessarily be included within, you know, sort of this digital and cyber revolution, because they might not have, like you mentioned in some of your stats, a computer at home.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there are a lot of elders that are also being left out of the mix because they don't have access to technology. In the libraries, they close eventually, you know. So and they only have so many computers, and you have to wait, and you get 15 minutes, and you gotta come back around, and like, who has time for that sometimes, particularly in the busy branches?
Right.
Yeah, are you talking about how to develop this alternative community that is actually, you know, one that's more activism kind of geared to be able to change some things, as opposed to, you know, you make your website, but then also sort of like the social good part of it, that
right.
part of it, like, are you all looking at any of that?
We absolutely are.
Oh, so super.
One of the things that, as I mentioned, our core, we do, you know, strongly believe our core and foundation to be here in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking forward to this fall, really doing more work in some of our communities and really getting our young people to develop socially responsible apps or apps that really address issues in their communities,
mm-hmm.
And really hits closest to them. So one of the organizations that we are partnering with to start some of that work is Symposium, which is part of the Life is Living Festival that happens in West Oakland in October.
Oh, and yeah, with Bumuti.
Absolutely.
Oh.
And so we're going to take a group of kids and help them to build some things like mobile applications or web pages that speak about their community, what's going on in their community, where are the STEM focused in their community, what are the needs, to really get them to not just do things, not that games are trivial, but not always do things that are, you know, focused for entertainment purposes, but really taking this tool and then, as you said, being able to activate it for change, for
mm-hmm.
social change in their communities, the things that are most relevant to changing things for their community.
Oh, that is awesome. Oh, that is really cool. So after your young people, you know, participate in your workshops or your series, I noticed that in the graphic that they're all carrying, you know, their briefcases and their laptops. are you able to facilitate, you know, getting, you know, hardware for those young people that don't have it in their families? Is that something that, you know, your partners are able to help you with?
That's one of the things that we're trying to get partners and corporate sponsorships to help us do.
Mm-hmm.
We found, particularly in this class that we have coming up at the end of the month, with such a huge amount of girls of interest in taking the program, that I would say more than half of them do not have access to computers in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing this even more to be very prevalent, as you had mentioned before, as we go in the communities, you know, so in Oakland or in Bayview Hunters Point.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge focus of something that we need, and that's one of the huge focuses of our campaign, so that we can get equipment for our girls to both use in class and then as well as provide some opportunities and connections to some computer companies that can help us get students the equipment that they need to continue to learn and develop the skills that we're teaching them.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I really hope that we can continue our conversation, you know, over the coming months, because I think this is something, you know, we definitely should check in about and see what's going on and see how people can plug in and how they can help you, because this is really, really fantastic. Your organization is really I'm really happy that you're doing this work.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And it's been a wonderful experience. It's been a busy year, crazy busy year, but it's been very rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and I'm really interested in the digital technology, because it's so portable. I just think about how, you know, Skype has made it so that we're not as isolated as we are when, you know, when it was just voice over wire. You know, now we can actually see the person or see
right.
the group or be in the country, you know,
right.
which is, yeah, and in real time. I mean, it's like happening. I mean, of course, there might be a little delay, but not a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really a bonus. So I was wondering, sort of in closing, if you could talk about, I'm still looking for that book I want to tell you the name of.
Okay.
I want to, was wondering if you could tell us about, you know, sort of, are you from the San Francisco Bay Area, and how did you get interested in a career, a science, you know, math and science-based career? I think that's really fabulous.
Well, I consider myself a Bay Area to be my home now, but I've only been here for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm originally from Memphis, Tennessee, so I'm from the South.
Oh, wow.
I've lived on the East Coast forever when we moved here.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it right away. You know, I just love the energy here in the Bay Area. I love the people. I just love everything about it. And so we really have adopted it as our home.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Oh, and how did I get involved? So I think for me, my introduction to engineering was definitely based on really having some strong guidance counselors and teachers as I was growing through grade school that really focused my attention on math and science. Those were actually were subjects that I had some interest in and actually had a lot of strong skill set in, and they really funneled me and directed my career path into engineering. And I attended engineering school in Nashville at Vanderbilt University, and it was difficult. So I always tell students, you know, hands down, you know, I don't want to mince words. It was very hard going through engineering school and being one of the few women in engineering topics, but I was just determined to stay the course, and I was determined to get that degree. Basically, as Malcolm said, you know, by any means necessary,
mm-hmm.
I was going to get that degree. And I happened to go to school when there was a bit of a spike in the number of women going into engineering and computer science,
mm-hmm.
but unfortunately now it has actually started to trend downwards.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the main reasons I feel is so, you know, important, the work that we're doing with girls and really getting them interested and, you know, kind of feeding the pipeline with women and women of color, particularly into engineering and into computer science, because it's definitely harder when you're the only one and you're alone. And we had talked about that a little bit before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the focus of really trying to feed that funnel and increase those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really interesting that we be having this conversation about the digital divide in 2012 when mm-hmm. I remember in, I think it was like 1995, when I was working on my master's degree, and I facilitated a program through the Berkeley Public Library called COIN, Community Opportunities, something, and but when one of the panels that we looked at, it was basically what I did is they were looking at trying to find out how the Berkeley Public Library system could better serve its African American community of users, and one of the topics that the advisory committee came up with was, you know, sort of looking at, you know, the digital divide. And I'm like, wow, you know, that was a long time ago, 1995. We're talking about the digital divide, and one would think if it was the fissure was you know, it was present and we could see it, but we could still step across it. Now,
right.
Now it's like, oh, I don't think so. I don't want to fall in there.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I'm like, wow. I mean, you know, you think if we knew that. You know, because a lot of times technology is connected to income. And, I mean, one thinks about technology, not just computers. One thinks about, you know, assistive technology for people that are not able to move, you know, like those of us that, you know, ambulatory. And you think about assistive technology in the classroom. And if you're at a better school, then the technology is better. If you're not, then you don't get jobs. You know, there is no, you know, so you're just struggling with something that, you know, there's technology, for instance, for dyslexia, but if you're not in that type of, if your school doesn't have those type of resources, you're just out of luck.
Sure.
So it's like, man, it's just so unfortunate that we know what we need, and the technology is present, and money, just money, I mean, like money, is the reason why it's not getting into the hands of the folks that could use it the most and who need it and who are just being left behind and left behind and left behind and left behind.
Absolutely.
It's like,
and I think here, we in the Bay Area, we see it all around us. So
mm-hmm.
we have such huge, you know, fathoms between those that have, you know, technology right at their fingertips
mm-hmm.
and, you know, those that don't. And that's real. The digital divide is still real. It's alive and it's kicking.
Yeah. And you know, you think like, because even with access, there's still discrimination. There's still isolation. I mean, I think about this young man that I met who was a poet in June Jordan's Poetry for the People. His name is Latif H. McLeod, and he had, you know, access to technology. You know, he's at UC Berkeley, but then he had the other types of exclusion. You know, okay, well, you know, you're an African-American male. You're disabled. I mean, there are all these other barriers, you know, and prejudices, beyond this other stuff. But at least he had the technology, so he could
mm-hmm.
speak, because
right.
if he didn't, no one would even hear him.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, so I'm like, man, this is so unfortunate. But I'm real happy that, you know, your organization is doing it. And William mentioned to me, William Hammonds, who introduced me to you, he asked me to ask you if you, he said to drop the name of Gerald Lawson, you know, his film,
okay.
A Great Day in Gaming, the Gerald Lawson story, and wondering if you had some words to share about this wonderful man and who is no longer with us, but who was able to go to this wonderful conference, and I believe you were present there.
I wasn't present at the conference,
okay.
Unfortunately, but I was able to, you know, see the film
mm-hmm.
when Will and his team initially first did the first showings,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's an incredible story, and it definitely needs to be told. I think, again, you know, Jerry Lawson was one of those unspoken, untold, unheard of heroes from more than, you know, just the African-American youth today, but youth in general, because he was brilliant, and he was doing things with technology and really considered among his peers that did not look like him for his brilliance, well before, you know, any of the contemporaries that we see, you know, so much of, and hear so much about now are spoken of. And I think, you know, Jerry is like the ideal role model for our kids of what is possible, in that they can take, you know, technology, they are capable, they are more than capable, and they can really create some amazing things and changes, you know, to our world by tapping into it. So I feel really strongly about having our young people see that, because those type of role models that, you know, the Jerry Lawsons and the other, we have several other role models as well that really were pioneers in the Valley a long time ago, and people don't hear those names. Frank Green is another one that was a pioneer in the Silicon Valley area, and folks don't know about Frank Green, but our young people don't, but they need to. They need to know about Jerry Lawson as well because we have really paved the way here as a people, and it, as in other areas as well, and we need to have those stories be told.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he's the African-American inventor of the video game cartridge system. What is the video game cartridge system?
Well, the video game cartridge system, so long before kids or folks in general could download a video game on their iPhone or their iPod or go to GameStop, I hate to say his name, but go to a store and get a small disc. They were like huge cartridges, almost like a video cassette, like what we would know as like a beta VHS video cassette.
Okay.
And there were those were like the earliest video games. So the video games that we have today, those were the grandfathers and the grandmothers of what we now know as modern video game technology. So they really set the pace and set the tone for what would become like the modern day video game.
Nice, nice, yeah. Well, that particular film is going to be screening on Sunday, too, I believe, right?
I think so. I think it's screening on both Saturday and Sunday, so I'm really excited about
that. Yeah, 3:30 on Sunday, and, yeah, so that should be really great. And I believe, let's see, I'm not certain if that's happening at the African American Art and Culture Complex, but your workshop is.
Yes.
And, yeah, and that's 762 Fulton Street. And I found the book. It's called Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. And it's by Rory O'Connor.
Okay, cool.
Do you know the book?
No, I don't. But
okay.
I'm writing it down right now in my iPhone.
yeah. It talks about the revolution, you know, the developments in internet technology, and he looks at, you know, how do we fact check? How do we know that that the corporations are not, you know, sort of infiltrating, you know, this democracy? Because, you know, the whole thing around cyberspace was, for all intents and purposes, it's a bigger democracy than, you know, our government is so far. But every time you turn around, you know, they're, you know, it's being eroded. and so, yeah, so it's a very, it's not a long book, but it's real dense, and I think you really like it since this is what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will definitely check it out.
Okay, cool, super. And why don't you give us your website? I don't know if we gave it earlier for folks to stay in touch and get, you know, signed up for these workshops before they fill up.
Okay. Our website is at www.blackgirlscode.com. We're also on Twitter at Black Girls Code, and we're also on Facebook at Black Girls Code ORG.
Okay,
so reach out in any way that you can. We'd love to have these girls in our classes.
Right, yeah. And Sunday again, the 17th, the workshop, Game Development with Kodu, from 12 to 3:30. It says, in this workshop, Black Girls Code will introduce kids to game development utilizing the Microsoft product Kodu. We will teach the workshops interactively using the PC interface. Students will be able to play their creations on the Xbox. Sounds exciting.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Are you going to be at the red carpet tomorrow? Are you going to be walking down the carpet?
I'm not going to be walking down the carpet, but I'll be there on the weekend. Stuff as I can.
All right, cool. I look forward to meeting you.
Okay, you as well. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for the great conversation. And,